We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, let's get things started, and I must apologize because last week...
We blew it.
Yeah, I guess we both did. Passing of a local longtime activist who's...
Icon, really.
Yeah, prominent in our community, Tom Warner. He passed away on October 24th.
This is a man who'd been active on any number of issues around left politics, his support of Pastors for Peace in Cuba was his passion. But he'd done a lot of things over the years. People were very familiar with him in the peace movement and social justice movements. And he'd been getting on in years, but he'd been doing this for many, many, many years. And he will very much be missed. There is a fund that's being set up in his memory called the Workers' Defense Fund. And unable to find a website on that yet, but I'm sure it'll be up soon, so people can check that out.
The Workers' Defense Fund Trust is
Workers' Defense Fund Trust.
What they're calling it. So.
Tom had been pretty specific about the types of grassroots struggles that fund will help to finance. So. So you can Google that and check it out, and it's very, very much a worthy effort, and very fitting to be organized in his memory.
Yeah. All right. So from there, let's move on to the largest event from the last week, which was the elections.
Oh, yeah, those.
Now that Java is no longer helping out a candidate.
Okay, let me tell you how I've been spending the last 8 months.
He can cut loose. Talk about the election returns, Java.
Yeah, well, it was really, first of all, working in electoral politics, which I had not done before, was a very interesting and revealing experience in a lot of ways. But... one of the things that we noticed in the course of the campaign, and we've been hearing from other campaigns as well, I was working on Diane Ferguson's city council campaign, was that the nature of donations, a lot of the attention on the impact of the Citizens United decision in early 2010 has been on its impact in federal elections, especially in 2010. This was the first time we really had a chance here in Washington State to see how that new climate combined with the economic downturn was going to impact local fundraising for local elections. And it was a very clear and very strong impact, and we saw it in the results. The net effect was that overall – donations to political candidates were up, but they weren't up that significantly. I think for the city council race, Tom Rasmussen may have set a record by being over $300,000, but people have come close to that before. So the real impact is that because of the economy, individual donations were down quite a bit. If you looked at the challengers for the race, none of them did particularly well in fundraising. The challenger who did the best and who had the best shot at unseating an incumbent in the city council races was Bobby Forsch, and he didn't raise $100,000. And you generally feel like you have to raise $100,000 to have a credible campaign, and really $200,000 to be truly competitive in this in this climate. He only raised $100,000, and if Godin hadn't been so vulnerable, and I'll get back to that in a minute, then it wouldn't have been a close race.
I think the numbers came out. The city council incumbents as a whole raised about six times what their challengers did. So the incumbents had about $1.35 million versus just about $200,000.
Yeah,
the
incumbent the incumbents were about $250,000 each on average. Yeah. But the real significant part of that was that the individual donations were down for the incumbents as well. It was the corporate donations that were way, way up.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the donations of a Gene Godin or a Tom Rasmussen or a Tim Burgess, you saw Boeing, you saw Microsoft, you saw Amazon, you saw, Martin Seelig and a lot of the downtown developers. You saw really a who's who of corporate Seattle in there, as well as any number of national corporations as well. And it made a huge difference. All five of the incumbents won for city council. But even more surprisingly, given how much opposition there was going in, three out of the four and almost all four of the school board incumbents won, which was very surprising. Now in Seattle, because the city council races are at large and you have to fundraise from the entire city. And again, for the school board in the primary, you have it by district, but in the general election, it's a citywide election. So, for school board, these are only people who make a few thousand dollars a year. It's supposed to be a part-time job, which is a joke, you know, overseeing a multi-billion-dollar empire like the Seattle School District, that the people charged with that oversight are only being paid a few thousand dollars a year, and have no staff assistance really in order, you know, to help process the massive amounts of research and paperwork and study that those folks have to do. But for a job that only pays a few thousand dollars a year, you were seeing much, much, much more than that being necessary at this point in order to elect those races because of the money that's going into those races. And so it becomes very hard for people who are not incumbents to raise that kind of money, so that even though there had been widespread criticism of how the school district had been run, the scandals that led to the firing of Maria Goodloe Johnson as superintendent last year, the performance gap between the well-to-do schools in the North End and the heavily non-white and immigrant schools in the South End that were lagging behind, that public criticism, which came from left, right, and center, was not particularly reflected in the election results. And it's a real disconnect between the conversation that's going on in the community and what is possible to do in an actual election campaign, because all, you know, Seattle is a large enough jurisdiction. More people live in Seattle than live in an average congressional district. So when you have to run for that kind of a seat as a school board or a city council candidate, you can't do it just by knocking on doors. You can't just do it with an army of volunteers. You have to have yard signs. You have to have direct mail. You have to have phone banks. All of those things. You have to have ads. All of those things cost money. They cost a lot of money, and the money for those elections right now is coming largely from corporate sources. And we're seeing that, and it's going primarily to incumbents who have the ability to give out favors and you know, essentially our system of legalized bribery that is the campaign finance system in this country. It really has made a difference at the local level. And, of course, we saw that also in the results reversed from last year in the liquor privatization bill as well.
Yeah, Costco has pretty much now established what the cost of buying an election in Washington State is. It's now $22 million, essentially.
Yeah.
And it helps if you outspend your opponent by 2-1 at least.
Yeah, and in most cases, you're not going to have another corporate source that can put in $10 million into the no campaign. You're going to be able probably to do it for somewhat less because you're not going to have as many deep pockets on the opposition side as what Costco ran into. But, you know that the math on that did not add up for what was being promised. And frankly, both sides were running a lot of deceptive ads in their campaigns. But, you know, that was not the how the initiative process in the Washington State Constitution was originally envisioned, was as a way for corporations to get laws that directly benefit themselves. But, you know, if you have enough money and you can buy enough ads and you can convince enough people that your self-interest is also in their self-interest, then you can buy yourself a law now. And it's a very disturbing precedent.
All right. Excuse me. Anything else on elections?
Well, we could talk a little bit, too, about the defeat of the $60 car tap fee. A lot of people I've noticed in the Seattle Times in particular, but in other news sources as well in the city, that a lot of people are saying, well, this is, once again, Seattle's rejection of Mayor McGinn. I think folks need to remember that it was the city council that put the $60 car tab fee on the ballot, the city council that was swept back into office. All of the incumbents were reelected, and that it wasn't a rejection, per se, of any particular politician. It was people looking at what the initiative would, what the $60 would have covered, looking at their own wallets and saying, not this year. you know, we don't know exactly what's in this $60 that is going to benefit us. Not enough is going to fix our roads, which are very, very damaged and need a lot of money put into maintenance and resurfacing. And we don't think it's worth the $60 coming out of our pockets to go into stuff that we don't know what it's going to be spent on.
And frankly, since the sort of marquee thing that money was being spent on that proposition was the extension of the South Lake Union streetcar and the streetcar network. Yes, Mayor McGinn has championed that, but it's also a pet project of Paul Allen and Vulcan because mm-hmm. of the property holdings that they have in South Lake Union and the fact that the streetcar network is not a transportation solution. It doesn't really do anything to help Seattle public transportation. It is a real estate project to help try and improve the property values in South Lake Union and the other areas of the neighborhoods that are directly affected by those streetcar lines, because realtors can then turn around and say the city is investing hard infrastructure in our neighborhoods. That's what that is all about. And so in many ways, it was a rejection of Paul Allen and it was a rejection of the sort of corrupt politics that benefit well-connected developers in Seattle. But that is not particularly a conclusion that the Seattle Times wanted to make. They would much rather use it to bash him again.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else in elections? Or
nope. Let's move on.
I think we should move along now. Yeah.
And developments this week with the XL pipeline.
Yeah, the Obama administration announced this week that the decision on whether to go ahead with the XL pipeline between Alberta and the Texas Gulf Coast to refine and ship to market the tar sands oil from northern Alberta, that decision has been delayed 12 to 18 months. This after the State Department had given a critical go-ahead on it a month or two ago, and that furthermore, the Obama administration sent it back to the State Department with a strong suggestion that they use that extra time to take another stronger, closer, let us say, maybe even reverse the decision kind of look at the at their go-ahead for the pipeline. This has been seen in the environmental community as a massive victory. Now it doesn't guarantee that the pipeline is not going to be built, but it certainly increases the odds by quite a bit. The flip side of that is that it delays the decision until after the 2012 presidential race. So if the Obama administration does want to push it through, they can wait until after they're electorally vulnerable in order to do that. So there is a danger that it won't be fulfilled, but it also doesn't get to the core issue, which is not so much the shipping of the tar sands oil to market. It's being mined in the first place and what that does for greenhouse gases in the environment in northern Canada, because Canada is also looking at the possibility of building a pipeline through the Canadian Rockies to the BC coast and shipping it to Asia that way. So the effort to actually get the extraordinarily environmentally destructive mining of the tar sands oil stopped in the first place does continue, but it looks like that pipeline is in very much in trouble. And, you know, coming on the heels of having 10,000 or so people surrounding the White House and wanting to commit civil disobedience on Sunday in order to make their point that the tar sands pipeline is a really bad idea, and coming on the heels of a months-long campaign by environmentalists to get that project stopped, it really can't be seen as anything but a victory for that effort.
Yeah, and you know what makes it possible for oil companies to dig up the tar sands and process them is the high price of oil, which is around $90 a barrel right now, increased to about $90 a barrel recently. On Tuesday, you know, this is the same week too that the Obama administration released their proposed 5-year plan for offshore oil drilling. So as he took one thing away from the oil industry, the pipeline to ship oil tar sand, the tar sands oil to the Gulf, he threw out another little Benny to the oil industry.
The oil industry really does like its bennies.
Oh, it does. And the 5-year plan would open new areas in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico to offshore oil drilling. I think all you need to do, really, well, in Alaska, a larger part of the ocean off of the North Slope would be included in that five-year plan, and the Cook Inlet off the southern shore of Alaska. And then in the Gulf of Mexico, there are areas off the coast of Florida that had previously been off limits to offshore drilling, which will now be open for oil drilling.
Wasn't there some kind of a problem with offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico
there
recently?
There was.
I can't quite remember the details.
Yeah, there was. And you know, in this era when climate scientists are telling us that we should expect more massive storms in the Gulf of Mexico, and we just saw a massive hurricane-like storm up in Alaska, one that particularly affected the north coast of Alaska.
Actually, it was more the west coast, but it was basically the
same area.
Well,
it was the west,
area.
And it was the northwest coast of Alaska.
Yeah, it tracked really far north compared to what happened in the past. And this was a midweek storm that actually some of the wind and rain that we got yesterday was one of the offshoots of that storm moving through here.
But to continue talking about the 5-year plan. I want to just point out that the nearest Coast Guard facility to the areas that are open for the 5-year plan is about 1,000 miles away. And there will only be one functioning icebreaker. Very soon there will only be one functioning icebreaker in the region, and it's a scientific vessel. So if there is a spill in those areas that are opened in Alaska for the 5-year plan, that's going to be, you know, it's very clear that the oil industry, when they looked at the emergency plans for dealing with spills in the Gulf of Mexico, it's pretty clear that the oil industry doesn't have a functioning plan in place to deal with major storms in Alaska.
Yeah, and the irony about that storm is it was particularly bad coming off of the western coast in the Bering Sea because unlike previous storms that they've had in past years, usually it hasn't been as bad because there hasn't been as much moisture to feed the storm because the Bering Sea is iced over this time of year. Well, it's not anymore because of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and colder. So the climate change is making the storms worse. At the same time, the climate change is being exacerbated by the drilling in the first place. So it's a really nasty little feedback loop they got going on
an,
there.
An endless cycle. Mm-hmm. And the Obama administration just decided, well, let's continue the cycle.
Let's make it worse.
Let's make it worse. Yeah.
Well, they do have elections coming up soon enough. So.
Yeah, and that's way more important than the future of, you know, the ability of you know, the biosphere to survive.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on the offshore oil drilling plan or Alaska storm?
Let's move on.
All right. Let's move on to another storm that occurred this week in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and we promise that we won't have a regular feature talking about sports news on this show.
Thank you.
Although, you know, there are some really good games today. No, never mind. The Penn State scandal was particularly revealing, I thought, this week. And I'm not going to talk about the assistant football coach for those of you who have been living in a cave or automatically tune out anything to do with sports. What happened in Penn State was an assistant football coach was indicted over last weekend for a number of counts extending over a number of years of sexually assaulting young children, including in the athletic facilities at Penn State University. That scandal led this week to the firing of its iconic head football coach, Joe Paterno, who has won more football games than any other college football coach in history and had a reputation for sterling, you know, moral virtuosity and so forth. Well, he was fired because he and a number of other people in positions of power at Penn State basically looked the other way and let this continue to happen for a number of years. On Wednesday night, students at Penn State University actually rioted, you know, overturning vehicles, fighting with police, etc. Although, oddly enough, the very white and well-heeled students didn't get pepper sprayed
or
assaulted with batons or anything like that.
They weren't rioting because, you know, young children had been raped by
Not only that. No, they were rioting because the coach had been held accountable for and had been fired for not intervening in the rape of students. It was basically a pro-child rape riot. And, you know, I mean, words fail, honestly, if that is because you could see saying about the Penn State and about that community, well, it's unfair that a brush
that a brush be used to tarnish all of the people who live there or go to school there just because of the misbehavior and the failure to intervene of a few powerful people who could have done something about this. But when you have literally something like 4,000 students, a goodly percentage of the student body, rioting because they don't want anybody held accountable for this scandal, you know, it's you really need to be starting to talk about things like shutting the entire school down. It's like, where are the priorities here? Is football more important than preventing the rape of young children? And, you know, somewhere along the line, priorities have gotten very, very seriously lost there.
It really says something about the culture where in an institution, the people who are never held accountable, who are held above everyone else, are the athletes and the folks who train and coach those athletes. It really says something pretty disgusting about that whole culture.
The flip side of it, yeah, I see, Mike. I see. We see you over there. He's playing with his fingers again. It's just not very. It's distracting.
I'm letting him know how much time is left.
There are a couple of good things to come out of this. Number one is that it has been an issue for years on college campuses that sexual assaults and crimes in general that are committed usually against women, but not always. Often by student athletes, but not always, tend to get swept under the rug. That's spotlight's being shown on that. Similarly, and much more broadly, this has been such a large story in the pop culture in this country that, excuse me, it really is a defining moment in a lot of ways, sort of similar to when Magic Johnson came out 20 years ago and announced that he had HIV. It really challenges people's preconceptions of who gets affected by these stories, that it can happen anywhere, that it can happen to a football coach as with a widespread reputation for doing things the right way as Joe Paterno, that this is a situation that can really come up anywhere, and that, you know, people in positions of power, especially who are confronted with this in the future, will look at what happened to Paterno, look at what happened in Penn State, and they won't ignore the situation. They won't sweep it under the rug. They'll take action. They'll intervene to help the victims in cases like this. And that's a potential future good that could come out of this. So it's not entirely bad, but the scandal itself is just gut-wrenchingly nauseating.
All right, appeals court in D.C.
Yeah, D.C. appeals court, federal appeals court ruling a panel 2-1 this week that the health insurance mandate of Obamacare is in fact constitutional. And what was interesting about there have been several appeals courts now ruling on this issue. In this particular case, it was the lawsuit of state attorneys general that Rob McKenna helped author. So he lost on this one, but it's going to go to the Supreme Court. But the D.C. appeals court was particularly revealing in terms of how the U.S. Supreme Court might rule on this, because the judge who authored the decision in this case is a guy named Judge Lawrence Silberman. And if that rings a kind of a vague bell, it's because Silberman used to be an aide to Ronald Reagan back in the day. And in fact, he got his judgeship in the first place as a reward that was given to him by Bush the senior for his role in the October surprise. He was one of the Reagan aides who was instrumental in negotiating with the Iranians to continue to hold on to the Iranian hostages at the embassy there until after the election in 1980 between Reagan and President Jimmy Carter. That scandal has never really been litigated in any kind of way. Silberman was also appointed by Bush the Jr. as the co-chair of the committee that was supposed to investigate Iraqi quote-unquote intelligence failures in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. And so in a lot of ways, Silberman is a right-wing political hack. He authored an opinion that basically said, Congress has the authority to do this. Congress has a basic right, and government has a basic right to act on behalf of the common good. And if he's making that case, it's going to be very difficult for even the conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court to say it's unconstitutional. I think it's a very good omen in terms of how the Supreme Court will eventually rule on that issue.
All right. On to international and the euro debt.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to talk about the euro debt crisis now that it's pulling in Italy. The first question everybody has is what happened? You know, how did it come to this? How did it go from Greece, a small economy, to Italy, which is the third largest economy in Europe? I think you have to look at the conditions in Italy. It has slow growth, but you know, it is growing, unlike Greece, for example. But Italy is also the fourth largest borrower in the world after the U.S., Japan, and Germany. Well, you might say, okay, how does it differ from Germany? You know, both of them are on the euro, so it can't be the fact that it's just the euro currency that's the issue. And to a certain extent, that's true. But there are two other things that are functioning here that a lot of people don't really see. One of them is panic. And the other one is magnification of risk. And I just want to talk briefly about both of those. In terms of panic, this week, a big clearinghouse in Europe required an increase in margin for trades on Italian debt. Essentially, what they did is they unilaterally said, we need to raise the interest rate here on Italian debt. So basically, one big clearinghouse could say, okay, if you're going to trade an Italian debt, you have to put more skin in the game, in other words. So one big company in our consolidated global financial system can essentially unilaterally cause an increase in interest rates on sovereign debt. That should stop people in their tracks and say, what?
Yeah,
European banks also have been dumping their Italian bonds because of risk management issues and new capital requirements. In other words, they need to get rid of some of their riskier investments because they need more cash on the books. That's something that we know. And then there's the magnification of risk. Italy is one of the European nations that lets investors buy and sell futures contracts tied to Italian bonds. That means that people can buy derivatives that ostensibly manage their risk if they buy Italian bonds. But in fact, as we know now, derivatives actually systemically magnify risk because once people start to pile out of derivatives, it can drive down the prices of the securities or vastly affect the securities that those derivatives are tied to. So that risk combined with panic can be a real problem. In addition, many holders of credit default swaps, that's credit insurance that they bought based on Italian bonds, have essentially decided since they couldn't cash in their credit default swaps when Greece's debt deal was announced, you know, that people would have to take a 50% haircut on their Greek bonds, they couldn't cash in their credit default swaps. So people who hold credit default swaps on Italian debt have basically started to decide that, well, credit default swaps don't do anything. Let's dump those too. So that's magnifying the problem as well. So the question too now is what's to be done? You know, Italy is too big to bail out. It's too big to fail. So it's come down to three options. Now, the euro bailout fund idea that France and Germany are still pushing, essentially no one wants to contribute to a fund controlled by a few heads of state in the European Central Bank when they don't know what the rules of the fund are going to be. And there's no collateral that any of these governments like Italy or Greece can put up to in order to get funds from to get bailout money from a bailout fund. So that idea is pretty much collapsing. There's another idea that the European Central Bank can just print money, can do what's called quantitative easing, which is what the U.S. government did in 2008 throughout the 4 years from 2008 to 2011. Well, the Eurozone treaty, however, doesn't permit the European Central Bank to do that. And Germany has worries about inflation if the European Central Bank just starts printing euros and throwing them around. And that just leaves one other solution, and more people are talking about it. It's the breakup of the European Union so that individual countries like Greece and like Italy can start up their own currencies again, print their own money, devalue their own currencies, and export their way. Because once you devalue your currency, your goods are cheaper. You can export your way out of your economic problems. That seems to be the route that may have to come.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State. Well, you can probably still find a few print editions sitting around town with good information on the Occupy movement, as well as endorsements for the the election we don't have to worry about anymore. You can also find it online, though, with additional material that's gone up since then, and we do continue to update it pretty frequently at www.eatthestate.org. So go look it up.